to The Science of Murder. This podcast discusses the intersection of crimes, mostly murder and serial killings, and the science that is used to catch the perpetrators. We will shine the spotlight on some of the pioneers of forensic science and techniques that were used to catch murderers. We will talk about how many notorious serial killers have managed to evade being discovered, as well as how they were ultimately caught and convicted. We will also discuss times where science, or the people wielding it, failed. My name is Lissa, and I'll be your host for the discussions of The Science of Murder. I'm not a forensic scientist, psychologist, or legal professional. I'm just one of the many people who are interested in the topic of true crime and its perpetrators. In my daily life, I'm a medical laboratory scientist. My profession is grounded in the how and why of biological and chemical data. I'm someone who looks at a clinical result and tries to see the human story behind the numbers. That's kind of how I look at these cases. I am curiously fascinated in the how and why these crimes happen and how science has developed to catch and convict the offenders. I'm here to open up those conversation topics that still aren't quite acceptable to the mainstream, but also ground them in my own love of science, scientific techniques, and psychological studies. I know I'm not the only one out here fascinated by the science of murder and true crime, so I want us to find each other and learn together. Today, we are discussing Eileen Wuornos. Society branded her a monster. Hollywood eventually made a feature film stating it explicitly. She wasn't likable. She wasn't soft, pretty, or socially acceptable. She did terrible things. She murdered 7 men. However, while she did very bad things, for, her basic human existence wasn't inherently one of them, and eventually, she flatly refused to apologize for surviving. In late 1989, Eileen Wuornos was invisible in all the ways that mattered to modern society. She was completely estranged from her biological family, essentially unhoused, and making a precarious living as a migrant sex worker along Florida's Interstate 75 in Central Florida, the transport corridors that run up and down the state. Long before her first shot was fired, she had been functionally erased by every social safety net meant to catch a human being. Then came November 30th, 1989. On a quiet stretch of road, she stepped into a car with a customer named Richard Mallory. What happened inside that vehicle became a raw, violent rupture, a high-stakes fight for physical survival. And the encounter triggered a deep fight-or-flight response, a visceral, I'm not going to take this reaction. What the public later labeled as cold sociopathy and indifference was actually something far more fundamental. A violent survival reflex. During her first trial, Wuornos testified to the brutal assault that had taken place in that vehicle, a testimony supported by physical evidence, including a broken steering wheel column noted in the immediate crime scene documentation. Whether the legal system acknowledged it at the time or not, Richard Mallory was a convicted, violent sex offender. And that single encounter broke her internal threat calibration permanently. It wasn't just an isolated incident. It lit a fire inside an already deeply traumatized, hypervigilant mind that felt completely backed into a corner by the world. And it marked her ultimate pivot from lifelong victim to deadly perpetrator. Self-defense? Likely, but it changed everything. to understand how Eileen Wuornos ended up on that Florida highway shoulder in late 1989, you have to trace a pipeline of severe compounding trauma that began long before she ever held that handgun. History doesn't excuse her actions, but it documents the exact environmental variables that helped shape her volatile reality. By the time she was 14 years old, she had already suffered years of severe, unchecked sexual abuse at the hands of family members and adult acquaintances, a dynamic that culminated in a pregnancy and given birth to a baby boy in a Detroit home for unwed mothers at 14 years old. The infant was immediately placed for adoption, and within 2 years of this birth, at age 16, she was permanently cast out of her grandparents' house, thrown into the streets to navigate adulthood with zero structural support, zero safety net, and no emotional buffer. In street culture, hypersexuality and promiscuity are frequently less about choice and more about survival mechanics. A direct symptom of early childhood trauma and the immediate necessity of trading intimacy for basic shelter. But street life also bred a deep, permanent hypervigilance. Over the next 15 years across Michigan and Florida, Wuornos built a long, documented rap sheet defined by intense emotional dysregulation and physical aggression. She was not a passive or quiet victim. She had a well-known explosive temper. Her record was littered with bar brawls, assault charges, and violent altercations with clients and acquaintances long before 1989. When your baseline existence is defined by chronic trauma, your brain's threat calibration breaks. Every conflict feels like an existential threat, and explosive reactivity becomes a primary defense mechanism. This is the crucial context that true crime narratives often sterilize. Eileen Wuornos was not a sympathetic figure by societal standards. She was rough, volatile, historically violent, and quick to snap. When she claimed self-defense in the 1990s courtroom, she faced a system that demanded an ideal victim. Someone quiet, submissive, fearful, and visibly contrite. Wuornos was none of those things. Her long-standing reputation for aggressive confrontations made her defense a massive uphill battle, allowing the prosecution to frame her violent outbursts not as the desperate reactions of a traumatized woman, but as the inherent nature of a naturally hostile predator. Most true crime coverage is written from a comfortable middle-class vantage point. When commentators analyze a life like Wuornos's, they treat the mechanics of absolute poverty as a series of strange choices rather than a relentless, exhausting survival matrix. Most people are only marginally aware of the brutal instability of living in short-term motels with no fixed address, no working kitchen, and no savings buffer. However, when you live with no fixed address and no support system, the basic math of daily existence changes. Paying day to day for cheap motels, as Eileen did, is infinitely more expensive than paying a monthly mortgage or apartment lease. You are constantly bleeding cash just to keep a roof over your head for the next 24 hours. living this nomadic existence without a reliable income, without a working kitchen, you can't buy bulk groceries or meal prep. Every meal is overpriced fast food or gas station fare. Without laundry facilities, maintaining basic hygiene for formal employment is a monumental hurdle. And without a door you truly own, every single interaction carries high physical and financial stakes. You can't just walk away from a dangerous situation when you have nowhere to go. Framing her crime spree through this economic lens does not excuse the violence. It explains the rapid velocity of it. She was trying to keep a fragile, collapsing daily existence afloat for herself and her partner, Tyria Moore, while operating under chronic systemic stress. Consider the prosecution's heavy focus on the items she pawned following the murders. They presented these pawn shop receipts as proof of cold-blooded, premeditated murder for financial gain, framing her as a calculated criminal mastermind. In reality, the items she pawned tell a story of low-value savage and sheer survival math. From Richard Mallory, she sold a camera, some tools, and a $20 ring. From David Spears, she sold an electric shaver and a pocket knife. From Charles Karksiden, she sold a mechanics wrench and an igloo cooler. From Troy Burris, she sold some cheap tools and some of his personal effects. She probably netted a few hundred dollars total. The coldness of selling a victim to a pawn shop, to an outsider, it looks like greed, but through that lens of absolute poverty, it's simply, he's dead and doesn't need it anymore, but it's another meal, another night with a roof over my head. A calculated robber looking for cash doesn't use their own thumbprint or recognizable aliases at local Florida pawn shops where they're regularly seen. She left a glaring, sloppy paper trail straight to her front door because she wasn't thinking about avoiding a detective's paper trail. She was thinking about getting $15 right now so she and Tyria didn't get kicked out of their motel room that night. When you're trapped in that extreme level of poverty, a dead person's tool set or watch loses its human association instantly. It's no longer Richard's wrench. It's two nights of shelter, a tank of gas, or dinner. Treating those pawn tickets as the cold-blooded calculation of a serial thief ignores the desperate hand-to-mouth mechanics of living on the edge. It's the difference between greed and sheer unvarnished survival math. Her history doesn't excuse what she went on to do, but it documents the conditions that shape a human life. She probably felt powerless and out of choices. Tired of being a victim, and the encounter with Richard Mallory lit a spark that raged inside her. 6 months of silence followed Mallory's death, and then came a rapid, chaotic spree ending in late 1990, almost exactly a year from the first death. Seven middle-aged motorists were killed along remote Florida corridors, including David Spears, Charles Karksiden, Peter Seams, Troy Burris, Charles Humphreys, and Walter Antonio. There was no grand master plan, no sophisticated forensic countermeasures, just a sloppy, desperate trial of physical evidence. The multi-agency task force built their case using classic 1990 forensic and physical investigative methods. The primary forensic thread connecting these cases was ballistics. Tool mark impressions on recovered 22 caliber lead slugs matched across multiple crime scenes, telling investigators that a single firearm was moving along those highway corridors. When the police eventually recovered the victim's belongings, she left partial and full thumbprints stamped directly onto local pawn receipts. Also, descriptions of two women attempting to sell items matched her and Tyria. Later, both she and Tyria were linked to an abandoned crashed vehicle belonging to Peter Sims, a victim whose body was never found. Witnesses reported seeing two women wiping down the crashed Pontiac Sunbird before fleeing, providing law enforcement with crucial physical descriptions and a probable linkage. Altogether, Eileen left a very sloppy physical trail, one of chaos rather than criminal mastery, and she stated that outright in recordings. It wasn't an investigation that took years. By January 1991, law enforcement closed in and arrested Warnos at the Last Resort biker bar in Volusia County. To lock down the case, investigators applied pressure to her girlfriend, Tyria Moore. Leveraging Moore's potential liability as an accessory after the fact, with minimal circumstantial evidence, police used Warnos's fierce protective loyalty against her. And it worked. To spare Moore from criminal charges, Warnos confessed to the killings, shielding her partner and while taking the full burden of the state's prosecution directly on her own shoulders. Eileen exhibited severe codependency and the desperate need for stability, and these dynamics drove her eventual confession. In those early arrest and trial contact moments, Warnos tried to present a conciliatory, hopeful face. See me as a person. Sitting at the defense table, dressed up for court, she looked remarkably like a ordinary suburban substitute teacher, desperately trying to show a polite, respectable face to a world that had already written her off as a monster. America in the early 1990s looked at her through a deeply puritanical lens. He was my husband. He was my brother. And even if he might have assaulted her, she's just a lesbian prostitute anyway. How dare she? And besides, she's ugly anyway, which she wasn't. A little weather-beaten and rough around the edges, but far from the caricature that they painted. She confessed, and she did express genuine remorse, even if it was centered on how her own tragic life had turned out. That reflects far more self-awareness than you see in almost any male serial killer interview on record. That double standard is the overwhelming foundational truth of what made the public so uncomfortable. Women are expected to be compliant, or at least invisible. As a society, we still struggle to acknowledge sexual assault, especially within sex work. And Wernos wasn't crazy in the comfortable clinical psychological sense. There was no convenient psychosis or textbook sociopathy that could be easily packaged, dismissed, and filed away. Hold her reality side by side with Ted Bundy's prosecution. Ted Bundy was a charismatic, educated male killer suspected in dozens of multi-state murders. And he was explicitly offered a formal plea deal for life in prison to avoid a lengthy trial. The state offered a charismatic, college-educated male serial killer who targeted young co-eds a pathway to live out his days in a cell, even while suspecting him of committing, what, 25 to 36 murders? However, for a broken, traumatized woman who killed men along highway corridors, men who may have also been violent toward her, the state wanted nothing short of absolute execution. Nick Broomfield called this out explicitly in his documentary. Even Ted Bundy was offered life in prison. This was never offered to Eileen. In May 1979, Florida prosecutors handed Bundy a deal to plead guilty to the murders of Margaret Bowman, Lisa Levy, and Kimberly Leach in exchange for a consecutive 75-year life sentence. Bundy refused it solely out of ego because he couldn't stand standing up in the open court to admit guilt. Eileen Wuornos was never given that choice. The state of Florida was willing to let a man who was already suspected of being one of the most prolific multi-state serial killers in modern American history walk away from the electric chair simply to lock in guaranteed convictions and avoid a costly, media-heavy trial. Yet they kept trying Eileen for capital murder even after having secured 3 death sentences. They brought Eileen Wuornos to trial or accepted capital pleas across 6 separate cases, racking up 6 individual death sentences between 1992 and 1993. And on top of this obvious bias, and before she even faced a jury, she was surrounded by systemic exploitation. Her girlfriend, the one she confessed to protect, Tyria Moore, sold her story for book deals. The investigating detectives of her case resigned in disgrace over trying to actively negotiate movie rights for her story while the case was still unfolding. Her adoptive mother, Arlene Prowl, an older woman who legally adopted Wuornos while she was in jail, presented a psychological lifeline to a woman abandoned her entire life. Yet Prowl quickly turned access to Eileen into a pay-per-view booth, charging media outlets $10,000 to $25,000 per interview. All of these people were selling her out, and while her self-appointed lawyer, Steve Glazier, Dr. Legal, sat on camera, strumming guitar, smoking cigars, and openly admitting his complete lack of capital trial experience, actively encouraging her to plead guilty to avoid lengthier trial proceedings, he was using her execution track to build a brand. British documentarian Nick Broomfield captured this entire ecosystem in his film, Eileen Wuornos, The Selling of a Serial Killer. Broomfield's quiet, unassuming, observational style allowed the opportunists surrounding her to expose their own motives. Footage from his documentary was eventually introduced as formal legal evidence in her appeals to demonstrate ineffective assistance of counsel. Ironically, in that 1991 to 1992 honeymoon phase of incarceration, meeting Prowl and Glazier gave Eileen a brief, tragic illusion that she finally had a family and a legal team who cared about her. For someone who had been abused and abandoned her whole life, an older woman calling her daughter was an overwhelming psychological lifeline. In those early court appearances, when she looked animated or upbeat, it wasn't detachment from her crimes. It was the disorientation of a deeply traumatized person who genuinely believed she had finally been saved. She put on a performance of sanity, trying to present as a good reformed Christian woman to please Prowl in the court, holding on to the belief that if she was cooperative, dressed nice, and told the truth about her abuse, the self-defense would actually matter. Instead, Glazier and Prowl pushed her to plead guilty or no contest just to manage the media rights and cash without doing the heavy legal lifting that's required in capital defense. And she eventually realized that the media and the court weren't interested in her reality. The flash of genuine grievance when she tried to explain the context of her abuse and was met with cameras flashing and closed doors was seen instead as a mask slipping. Once incarcerated, Warnos posed zero physical threat to society. Yet the state spent millions of dollars endlessly prosecuting her in multiple counties, rather than locking in a single life sentence and managing her severe psychological decompensation. Her lack of performative remorse wasn't the calculated detachment of a textbook sociopath. It was the total emotional desensitization of someone whose baseline existence had been severe chronic trauma for decades. When physical survival is your only operating framework, emotional remorse becomes a luxury you cannot afford. She committed three unforgivable deviations from what puritanical society demands of a woman, an ideal victim, or even an ideal offender. She was weather-beaten, rough around the edges, and visibly worn by decades of harsh living. She wasn't the sanitized Hollywood version of a female sex worker. In a culture that conditions a woman's worth based on physical attractiveness, her refusal and inability to look soft or pleasing made the public view her as inherently dangerous and other. She survived by performing full-service sex work on highway turnouts, an industry created and sustained entirely by male demand, yet reviled by the very culture that utilizes it. Society consumed her labor while treating her existence as moral pollution. On top of these offenses to puritanical standards, she was living openly in a queer relationship with Tyria Moore, which added another layer of societal hostility. To the conservative public in 1990 Florida, a rough, street-hardened woman living with another woman completely shattered traditional gender expectations. Society had no sympathy for her, and by the time the legal machine finished with Eileen Warnos, it had generated six death sentences and thousands of pages of transcripts. However, if you want to understand the circus that actually tried her, you have to look through the lens of British documentarian Nick Broomfield. In his 1992 film, Eileen Warnos, The Selling of a Serial Killer, Broomfield didn't set out to produce standard sensationalized true crime. His signature style is quiet, unassuming, and disarmingly gentle. He walks into a room carrying his own boom mic, simple questions, and steps back. And when you don't press people, they tend to hand you their true motives on a silver platter. What Broomfield caught on camera wasn't a defense strategy. It was an ecosystem of vultures harvesting a human being. His footage was so damning, it was eventually entered as formal evidence into her legal appeals to prove ineffective assistance of counsel. Broomfield didn't have to attack anyone. He just let the camera roll while every institution surrounding a broken, impoverished woman treated her pending execution as a commercial asset. When you watch clips of Eileen Warnos across your feed, there's a striking contradiction. She isn't the monster of urban legend. She's surprisingly grounded. She openly stated that the police let her become a serial killer, that she wasn't smart, that she was a sloppy, hot mess, and they simply didn't care. And they didn't. They didn't care until it was clear that she wasn't stopping. They didn't care until it was a woman. They didn't care until there was notoriety and money to be made. And when she eventually expressed anger, her rage was a direct pushback against how she was perceived versus who she actually was, calling out how different her reality was from male serial killers or the serial killer pop culture myth. She completely shattered the classic criminal mastermind archetype. Male serial killers like Bundy or Dahmer revel in the illusion of control, playing intellectual games or posturing as criminal geniuses. Wuornos did none of that. She was raw, messy, and brutally candid about her own incompetence and survival instincts. Her anger wasn't rooted in a desire to seem terrifying or impressive or the smartest person in the room. It was a deeply reactionary pushback against a system that had ignored her plight for years until she became a headliner. When she blew up at reporters, it was because they were trying to paint her into a clean, digestible box as either a cold-blooded monster or a calculated vigilante. She hated both caricatures because neither reflected the desperate, chaotic reality of her life. My view on this isn't that she was acting in pure, blameless self-defense every single time, but rather that her initial spark was an inflated, trauma-driven defense mechanism that eventually spiraled into preemptive predatory action. When your baseline existence is defined by chronic abuse, your brain's threat calibration completely breaks, and you begin to interpret every slight, every shift in power, and every tense interaction as an aggressive, life-threatening escalation. What may have started as an explosive survival reaction crossed a lethal threshold, teaching a broken brain a dangerous lesson. If I strike first and take absolute control, I can never be victimized again. That isn't cold criminal mastery, it's an inflated self of self-preservation turning lethal. She is a murderer, but she's not the monster of mass media's portrayal. The public reaction to Eileen Wuornos wasn't just about the seven men she killed. It was a visceral societal punishment for who she was and her refusal to perform the expected role of a contrite female offender. Justice was served in the literal sense that a killer was removed from the streets, but it was far from blind. It was politically motivated, gendered, and selectively punitive. When she finally faced the brutal reality of her situation in the mid-90s, she began to pivot once again. The grift became undeniable. Her lawyer was chasing fame, her adopted mother was charging for interviews, and the cops were selling movie rights. Any illusions that she held were cracked wide open. She was no longer willing to play along with a rigged game. She stopped cooperating with her legal team, fired her representation, dropped her remaining appeals, and ultimately demanded her own execution. Eileen decided that dying on her own terms was the only way left to exit a circus that had exploited her from day one. By 2001, when Nick Broomfield interviewed her again for Eileen, Life and Death of a Serial Killer, right before her execution, her affect was completely obliterated. The early smiles were gone, replaced by raw, burning paranoia, wide-eyed exhaustion, and intense hostility. By 2001, the delusion had vanished. She was well aware that Prowl and Glazer had used her for media checks. Her appeals were failing, and the state was going to kill her regardless. The shift from the early tragic optimism to her final explosive anger captured the exact moment she realized the machine was going to grind her down no matter what performance she put on. The wide-eyed, defensive anger Broomfield captured at the end wasn't madness in a vacuum. It was the raw, burning fury of someone who realized that even the people who claimed to love her were just holding their hands out for a check. When female killers are put on trial, the legal system and the media demand a very specific performance. Tears, visible remorse, soft clothes, and head-bowed submissiveness. Warnos flatly refused to perform any longer. She spoke loudly, glared at reporters, called out the hypocrisy of the courtroom, and refused to pretend she was sorry for surviving the only way she knew how. She wouldn't play the weeping penitent offender for a courtroom or a camera crew, and that defiance is what made society hate her almost as much as the murders themselves. Her ultimate surrender of dismissing her legal team, waiving the remaining appeals, and demanding the state execute her wasn't a dramatic theatrical statement. It was a profound, bone-deep exhaustion. She knew the machine was going to kill her. She was done fighting a world that she had been at war with since childhood, and she wanted the noise to stop. On October 9th, 2002, the state of Florida executed Eileen Warnos by lethal injection. Was it justice? Maybe, but it wasn't a blind one. Her perspective that the system effectively just let her keep going because of who her victims were and who she was is a damning critique of law enforcement's historical blindness to crimes occurring on the absolute margins of society. She wasn't a criminal mastermind executing a complex fantasy matrix. She was a severely traumatized, marginalized person operating in pure survival mode with zero safety net, escalating until the inevitable collapse. Seeing that grounded, unfiltered reality on video strips away the urban legend and forces people to look at the bleak, unvarnished intersection of severe trauma, systemic neglect, and violence. It's a fascinating, deeply uncomfortable case to analyze precisely because it refuses to conform to standard serial killer tropes. Eileen Wuornos was never the monster that pop culture made her out to be. Did she commit murder? Yes. But the legal system didn't just prosecute Eileen, it executed an indictment on the very trauma, poverty, and non-compliance she represented. The state executed her for murder, but society vilified her long before she ever pulled the trigger, simply for existing outside the acceptable boundaries of class, beauty, sexuality, and decorum. Can you hold two conflicting ideas as truth at the same time? Can you feel empathy for individuals who have done horrific things? The forensics proved the crimes, but examining the circus that followed, the grifters, the missing plea deals, the six death sentences, and the refusal to see her as anything other than an unpardonable, non-compliant caricature is where we have to ask whether the process was ever about true justice or just systemic retaliation. The forensics aren't in question, but justice might be. Next week, we're going to take a look again at some of the latest forensic science advances and breaking developments in current cases that are making headlines across the country. So if you haven't already, Please like and subscribe to The Science of Murder to continue analyzing these cases along with me. And if you found today's deep dive into the complex forensic, psychological, and judicial reality of Eileen Wuornos fascinating, please take a moment to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred platform. Reviews are the lifeblood of an independent show. They help other science-minded true crime fans find our community. I highly encourage you to tell your accomplices, I mean friends, to come learn along with us. I always want to hear your analytical breakdowns of these cases or any future topics you want to see dissected on the bench. You can find me on Instagram or Patreon at Science of Murder, or reach out directly via email at scienceofmurder@gmail.com. Stay curious, stay scientific, and I'll see you in the next episode.